listening to the Warden Alumni Executive Education Podcast.
Hello and welcome everyone to the Wharton Alumni Executive Education Podcast. I am your host, Alex Gromatsky, and today I'm going to be talking to Brad Flager, who is an AI and machine learning expert. I know a lot of people call themselves that, but he has been working on AI projects since 2008, so for over 15 years now, and he has a book called AI Harmony, and he is also an advisor to NextFab Ventures, where he dives into the technical diligence of companies pitching themselves that are implementing AI projects. So thank you for being on today and look forward to this conversation.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Yeah, hey, Brad. So AI and machine learning are kind of the hot topics going on right now, especially. And you are not just, I'm going to call you an expert, but also an AI and machine learning educator, I guess I should say. How did you get into that and when did you get into that?
Sure. So I went to a strange liberal arts college and studied computer science, where I was one of three computer science majors back before it was cool to be a computer science major, I guess. Currently, they have like 40 a class or anything. But anyway, I got roped into doing complex systems and published while I was in college doing some neural network stuff. This is like 2008. So kind of trained on it in college and then stuck with it. My first job was doing high frequency options trading at kind of a hedge fund who could afford to do fancy AI before it was cool. So from early on, it's been just part of what I do, let's say.
Okay, and what made you get interested in that? Because 2008, that's, you know, 15 years ago, neural networks is something that people, you know, talk about nowadays when it comes to deep learning and maybe generative AI. What was it like back then 15 years ago and how has it changed over the years?
Yeah, I mean, the networks we were using were really small. We're now doing like large millions of parameter type networks. I think I had a paper published on schizophrenia that was using thousands of neurons, not hundreds of thousands or millions. And so that's kind of what it looked like. Basically the exact same stuff, but much smaller compute power. I mean, Yann LeCun, the director of Facebook, was doing OCR, character recognition type stuff for banks back in the early 90s using neural networks, but again, just like smaller compute, let's say. And for me getting into it, my first job one of my first jobs in high school was working for a financial planner. So like, and now that I'm educating, like one of the first projects every student wants to do is like, I want to make a machine that makes money, right? I want to like trade the stock market with AI, basically. And that was my first project in my head. So I did, right? I was econ, computer science, and I went into high frequency trading, trying to do exactly that, which I learned a bunch, and it was fun. All those projects initially, right, fail. If you're just using public data, you have no edge. But I learned, which was cool.
And you talk about high frequency trading. So how was high frequency trading and AI used back then?
So some of it is about like classifying anomalies. So you have like anomalous kind of huge trades come in that you want to kind of keep an eye on, because otherwise you can kind of stay all day and make, let's say, buy a stock at $99 and sell it at 101, and kind of, as long as buy and sell orders match up, you make that spread all day. And that's what I was doing. I was doing high frequency trading for a market maker. And what happens with a market maker is sometimes you come in, you get huge flow on one side. You're like, oh, well, that's curious. Is that some kind of corporate action we didn't know about? Is that some dividend announcement? Or is that insider trading or something, right? So that's the first step, is kind of anomaly detection, kind of similar to how people detect fraud or fake news or similar models today. And the rest of it is pricing, right? So drawing these curves on, right, what are the possibilities of the future price of Apple stock this month, next month, the month after that, and coming up with good pricing around that. So those are, I think, the two big components then and now too.
And you said you were training these models based on this public data back then, and
not public. I mean, public data back then, kind of. I think it's easier to get options options chain data, but the thing about options chain is like it's high throughput, high frequency, because it's not, you're not just trading Apple stock, you're trading every strike price for weekly, monthly, and yearly options. So you have for one underlying stock, one underlying, you have thousands of prices related to that. And then so it, not some of it's like paid subscriptions and like dividend precise dividend timing and earnings timing matters for all these things. So like I would say semi-public data, but certainly not like some kind of insider trading data, let's say.
Oh no, and I didn't mean that by any means. But it sounds like based on some of the things you're talking about as well, you had a computer science background, but you also have to have a pretty good background of finance and understanding options trading and stock trading in general to do some things you were doing. So how did you get that background as well?
So double majoring was part of it. And then I graduated from undergrad in 2009, so the middle of financial crisis of that era. And I had two options. I was either going to be an accountant in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I was good at my accounting. I was a teaching assistant in accounting and computer science at the same time. So I could go be an accountant, or I could go to grad school at the London School of Economics and study economic history. So I did that, and econ history it was fantastic. I learned a lot about finance too. I did study abroad at LSE, and yeah, like I said, for me the coolest place to work with my computer science skills was at a hedge fund. Like I didn't want to build interfaces. I'm not in love with building software for software's sake. I built some apps in my day, but it was like I want to use software to make money, and finance was the place to do that.
Yeah. And what has that journey been like, and where have you seen some of the biggest benefits of your background and your expertise, given that you have so much history in this specific area, and it seemed like the perfect skill set to go down this path? And now you've been in it as probably one of the earliest people, and now where AI is now, how do you see that, and how's your path been?
Sure. I think for me, AI is about decision making. And that's what investing is about too, right? Every AI makes a decision, whether even generative AI, it's taking text and predicting what's the next word, what's the next sequence of words. And you think like, not like I said, anomaly detection, same thing for, if you want to take a picture of my skin and diagnose cancer, picture of an x-ray and say, is this COVID or is this pneumonia? You want to say, is this a threat, right? Is there an active airstrike coming in from Russia to Ukraine right now using it? It's all decision making and kind of classification fundamentally. And for me, kind of the good training you get in economics on like how people make decisions, how people are less than rational oftentimes, really helped me in kind of implementing AI. And then in now working in startups, right? I sit on a venture capital board, I'm sitting and playing Shark Tank all day. That investment plus technology is right there, and it's like, okay, is this, am I buying this company or not? So I think it lives in my brain simultaneously. I would also disagree that I'm one of the earliest. Like Renaissance Technologies has been killing it using AI, you know, since the late 80s, early 90s. So I think given the current wave, it feels like I'm early in the game, but I think this is just the latest kind of AI summer that we have today.
And you mentioned that you're an advisor board member on a VC fund, and I think it's NextFab Ventures. So what do you do on that side of things? You said it's like a shark tank, and you do some advisory for them as well, or do you go on the technical side and do the deep technical due diligence on certain investments? What's your experience been there?
Both. So my day job is I help people automate and outsource software development. So be like AI solutions engineering for people, but also have an outsourcing shop with about 250 developers, mostly in Eastern Europe. So I'm the resident software guy. NextFab Ventures is a hardware focused venture fund. And what happens is we get a lot of people coming in with big fancy hardware projects, a lot of medical devices just because we're in Philadelphia, and they most often have a software component. And I'm the guy who challenges, like, is the software real? Is it good? Is it buildable? What's their staffing plan like? What is this, what they wave their hands and call artificial intelligence? Is it actually good, monitored, explainable, validated, anything like that? So due diligence and vote up and down on the investments.
So companies will essentially come and pitch to Next Fab Ventures. They'll make certain claims saying, hey, we're going to build these incredible technologies and softwares and like in Philadelphia, medical technologies. And then you could come and say, well, this is not possible. Like, you guys are out over your skis. Yeah. Or actually, this is a great idea. This could be done. You guys just have to staff some of the right people, and this can actually be viable on that side. Is that kind of the idea?
Yep. And it's a conversation. I talk directly with the applicants or the founders. I don't sneakily go behind the scenes and try and, private investigate them or anything.
Oh yeah. No, I meant more from a diligence technical standpoint, because, they might be just having a pitch, right? A presentation pitch, and then the diligence side might come after that. So that's a really cool experience. What are some of the, I'm going to say, best or most innovative applications that you've seen companies then do, since you seem to be exposed to a lot of different projects?
Yeah, I feel like an old man sometimes in AI, where, like, I think one of my big predictions is that any company right now who's making pure artificial intelligence, like pure AI models, software, that's worthless, precisely worth zero. And I'll explain why in a second, but I think the companies that are implementing AI to improve their processes are the ones that are going to win. Let me explain 1 second. So Meta, Yann LeCun, we have OpenAI exists, but Meta recently just announced this Llama 2 open source generative model. Basically the same thing as GPT 3.5, maybe not as good as 4, but it's free and open source. So any company who's making a generative model has to compete with free, and has to compete with Facebook, functionally a monopoly. To me, it's very similar to AT&T and Bell Labs back in the 60s, 70s, early 80s. I think big tech is kind of giving us all this stuff for free, and why would you compete with them? So any company that is trying to compete with them in any way, I think, is worth zero. On the other hand, I think companies that can take a lot of this open source software and implement it well to improve, for example, in medical technology, like diagnostics. And the more specific, the greater the pain point, the better. Like, we just interviewed a company that's making epilepsy monitors for people who, like, are at risk of dying in their sleep. Okay, the tech, the AI is, I'm gonna say, not that fancy. It's easier to do now than it was 5-10 years ago, but the tech is doable, let's say. But the I think the impact is huge, and the company could be worth a ton if they do it and get it right. So stuff like that, it's like very simple, like classification for really important problems, I think are most exciting to me.
So your thoughts, if I can rephrase, are if you're just trying to do something on the AI side to build something AI competitive, that people can plug into and use and build a software or an app on, probably not going to be that great, because people have the tools like ChatGPT 4 and the platform that you mentioned that Meta just came out, and people are able to just plug into that, build their platforms on that, similar to how people build their apps on AWS, and can just use that as kind of a backbone. So therefore there's no real use case for going out and building your own platform that people will build in. Is that kind of right, or did I misinterpret that?
Yeah, I think there's some details I would challenge it, but yes, like, it's really hard, I think, to win as an AI software company, because you have to compete with free and open source software. Mm-hmm. And I think it's almost impossible to compete with free and open source software. And even furthermore, right, if there were no open source models out there, you can recreate ChatGPT from Chat, like, it can self-replicate in a way. You can, right, type in text, get prompts, and then train a new model off of those texts and prompts. Now you would be breaking the OpenAI's license for using ChatGPT, but if you can't tell, if a person inspecting your model can't tell where the data came from, that license is kind of bunk anyway. Like it's not worth the paper it's or the server it's hosted on. So I think these models are super important. I'm super happy they exist, but the price of them is going to go way down to almost free. And the only, it's almost like people liken, and I'm annoyed at the people who liken AI to a nuclear bomb, but for a second, let's do that. It's the if you just watched the Oppenheimer movie, this is also maybe clear to you, like the idea that you could make a nuclear bomb was kind of obvious to every scientist. Once it was done, you have that proof of concept, and the cost of developing that first bomb is huge. But the second bomb is almost free. It's like that knowledge, the data wants to be free. Like the recipe is out there. Now, there's a core component that you need for a nuclear bomb, uranium, plutonium, that you can control. And that's how we do nuclear arms control today, right? It's like Iran is enriching uranium. We say, no, no, no. But for AI, yeah, we can say NVIDIA chips, but a lot of these models run on consumer hardware. Like they run on phones and laptops. So therefore the recipe is out there in the world, but there's no critical component that we can really control. And furthermore, these models, if they're public, the big thing you need to train a model is data. A public model can generate data.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to protect IP in this space and a public model at all.
Which makes sense. So then let me ask a layman's question. So what was ChatGPT trained on? Because if I'm understanding you correctly, you know, ChatGPT is, to my understanding, one of the first big adopted AI models or open source AI models. They're not charging for it. You said Meta's come out with a free one. So I think I'm hearing you say that other people could probably come out with their own, because now that they've seen how ChatGPT does it, you know, a lot of that cost has been borne already. But how did they build it? And if I misinterpret anything, please correct me as well.
No, can I share my screen for 2 seconds? I'll show you the website where you can find that their training, one of their biggest training data. And this is a public data set. It's been around for forever. Let me just share for 2 seconds. Here it is. You go to commoncrawl.org. And what this is it is the web, the entire web scraped and put in files that are easy to be trained upon. But it's just text from the web. Great. Now, there's a lot of organizing and data cleaning that OpenAI did to make their model good. They also added additional data sources. Like, for example, there's like Enron emails. Like, because Enron, all the emails from Enron were made public as part of their downfall and investigation, you have good back and forth kind of conversations there that you can train a model. So a lot of this data is public. A lot of these models are trained on the same data. And it's not actually the data that's a problem. It's how well you clean it. But if you're going to make another ChatGPT, you don't need to use the raw Common Crawl web data. You can use ChatGPT itself or Llama itself, which I said, again, breaks their terms. But if nobody can tell what your model is trained on, those terms are kind of, my perspective, irrelevant. You just have kind of like model IP theft all over the place. Which if you go to like the Free Software Foundation, which I am a supporting member, they kind of think that software patents are kind of nonsensical from the beginning. And I'm one of those people who kind of generally agree. I think it's really hard to protect software patents.
And the idea behind protecting a software patent is because they always need upgrades. You're always doing updates. You're always changing the software, doing the next version of it, so people can always improve it, change it, make some technical improvements. And it's just really hard to say that this was a direct violation unless you keep updating the patent as well. Is that correct?
I think there's that argument. But even from a practical standpoint, like there's all it takes is one leak and your software is out there. And it's copy and pasted everywhere. So from a practical standpoint, I think it's hard to protect. Like we've seen it with like big game, like Grand Theft Auto 5 or something, right? Like all the source code leaked for that. Llama itself, it's open source model now, but it initially leaked from Facebook. I think it was probably a planned leak. Who knows about that? But, and yeah, it's like, we have a world right now. We have software patents for things like rounded buttons on icons and ridiculous patents that are basically just not being enforced right now because they're not being taken to court. It just doesn't work. It is made up, right? Like the idea that I can protect an idea is wild, right? Especially an idea that I can so easily copy and paste. Now, I think it's useful, right? We think we aren't going to have big drug companies developing new drugs if we don't have a patent system. I'm not trying to say patents are ridiculous. I think software patents in particular and publicly available software, really, really, really hard to do in practice. That's my story on software patents.
And I appreciate that, and I appreciate the details into that, because my understanding is that you can write code to perform the same functions in a few different ways, maybe adding additional security features and things like that, or just changing the verbiage or wording, so to speak, or writing in a different language. That's interesting to think about that, because I hadn't thought about that before. So then what's your thoughts as to, obviously ChatGPT has been very successful, adopting a lot of users, getting a lot of subscribers. Now Meta's coming out there. I didn't even know about this Meta platform yet. I didn't know that this is out there. So what's your thoughts as to, you know, why they did this? And I think Elon Musk was an early person that supported them, and he wanted this to be open, and he never had intention of making this like a profitable business. And maybe, you know, this is what they kind of get. And I don't want to put words into your mouth, but what's your thoughts as to, then why are they building this, or what was the intention behind this, or what's going to be their next plans, and what should people be doing with these open source softwares, given that they can be replicated, and that probably other companies, you know, Meta and maybe IBM or somebody else will maybe make their own open source softwares available?
Yeah, so I think there's two different strategies to talk about. There's a strategy for governments and big companies, and then there's a strategy for everyone else. I think for big companies, I can't explain why they do what they do. I think OpenAI was founded as a nonprofit. They have a subsidiary now that's profit limited. So I think some of the researchers on this kind of knew, like, hey, this stuff, once we release the Kraken, once we release this thing, it's going to be easily copyable. There's a famous Google memo now that says, we have no moat, nor does OpenAI, that talks about this exact problem. I think a lot of smart engineers can look ahead and say, this is amazing. This tool is amazing, but it's indefensible. I think Microsoft might have already profited from their investment, right? $10 billion or something like that into OpenAI. They grabbed some search revenue share and it sped up development for them. So maybe they don't need to protect their IP. Maybe it was just about speed of development was that investment. I think, right? But you've seen like Bard, Google has their version. Facebook has their version, and then Facebook makes it free. So Facebook already broke the market, I think, for this. So the cost of these models is going to go down significantly and will continue to go down. Now, what happens with the latest model development? Or you also have regulators coming down and saying, well, you have to tell us where you got your data. You have Hollywood striking, saying, for me, the cat is already out of the bag. Pandora's box has already been opened. These models aren't going to go away because there's all these open source kind of hacker versions of these models out now that are free, available to use. And they've already used all the private data, all the movie pictures, all the books, copyrighted books, all that stuff is already used. And yes, even though these companies are promising, we're gonna put fingerprints on them to make it detectable, there's already tools that are not detectable. So that's not gonna go away. So what happens in the future of that is really like, it's a government issue. It's like big megacorp monopolies and the government. And like, I kind of don't care, right? I don't care what happens. The fact is that there are excellent models out today that can automate a ton of boring, terrible, tedious work. And if you're not those big companies, your job is to take those models and automate terrible work away. And that's it. Like, implement those models. Sure, you can pay for them, you can get them for free, you can train your own, it doesn't matter. But that's I think the wave we're in now. And I think the models are powerful enough that I don't think we need a ton more model development. Like, we don't need a better chatbot. Like GPT 3.5, GPT 4, Llama 2, Anthropics, Claude, Jurassic 2, all these models are excellent. They're really good. Like, they're better than humans already in most tasks, right? And they just need to be deployed. So now we're in the deployment phase. I think it's cool to think about the sci-fi world we could go into, but to me, it's like, doesn't matter. Assume that AI development stops tomorrow. Let's just assume that. That's one of Dr. Ethan Mollick's four scenarios you should plan for. But assume it stops tomorrow, we still have a ton of work we can automate away. And I think it's going to take us a long time to do it. That's one thing that you learn in economic history. That's why I'm happy I studied economic history, especially in this age, is that it takes a long time for tech to impact productivity, right? Like, it doesn't happen instantly. Like, we don't have self-driving cars today, and we're probably not going to have self-driving cars for like 10 years. And even then, it's going to take a long time for us to do that. And a lot of that is culture, right? We have culture getting in the way. And I see it all the time with my clients. We're like, I'm selling outsourcing, which is a very old idea, and automation. And people still don't get it. They're like, oh no, we need FaceTime and we need in-office work and all this other, like, people fight it because it's the culture. They have a culture of in-person work, a culture of manual work. And that's going to be a huge barrier to change for a lot of companies. So I think the strategy for these companies is like, get with it. Like I said, automate away jobs with AI. That's the headline. I read a Wall Street Journal article the other day. It's like the most, like, I forget how they ranked. It's like the savviest company, that most AI savvy companies are also hiring the most AI developers. It's like the lead is being extended because they're doubling down and investing even more. So I think.
But your take on that would be, that's not a great idea, because your thinking right now is all the AI tools are already here. You just need to deploy them and integrate them to enhance efficiencies for your.
I wouldn't get it confused, right? I'm saying that if you're a company that's competing with Google, OpenAI, Facebook banking models, you're foolish. That is what I'm saying, is foolish. If you are taking models that already exist and deploying them to get rid of people's busy work, to improve sales funnels, to quote products faster, to do better inventories, to do fuzzy matching, quality control, better diagnosis for health. Like, if you're implementing these models, that's the smart thing. That's what I'm talking about, hiring to implement existing models, not companies like, oh, I'm the next AI startup that's gonna make the next ChatGPT. Like, that company, I promise, is gonna fail. 100% of those companies are gonna fail. Right, because the economics are so weird. It's big. Yeah. It's big government economics. The scale is too strange for a startup to compete. Where if it's Capital One hiring a bunch of AI and like, listen, we want to do loan approvals faster. We want to eliminate paperwork. We want to like predict. We want to do fraud better. We want to get rid of branches and improve ATMs. Right, like all that cost cutting and job elimination that they can do at Capital One is going to make them an excellent company.
So,
and that's what I think people should do.
And what type of people should people think about hiring? Because, you know, when I think about website development, right, like basically it used to be like WordPress, but you still need to have some coding. Now you can use platforms like Wix and a ton of other ones where it's just drag and drop. And now there's some AI platforms that allow you to create websites, I think, which is even less work than drag and drop. I don't even know what that looks like anymore. So what is your thoughts about what type of people companies should be hiring to implement some of the benefits that can come from automating and getting rid of these useless tasks when it comes to AI? Because in my opinion, you know, ChatGPT is great for, you know, doing searches and doing stuff and writing some stuff. But if you're like a layman and you don't have coding experience, if you don't really, you know, if you're not an app developer, if you don't really know how do you integrate this, where is your thoughts as to making AI or ChatGPT more user-friendly so that the average consumer or people in their 50s or 60s can start to use this and say, hey, I want to automate, you know, whatever I want to automate?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm almost religious about this point. So forgive me when I go there. I think everybody needs, like, you're making it more user-friendly. Like, it's already so user-friendly, right? Yeah. I think people need computer science education more than we need more user-friendly products, right? And every company needs to be more of a tech company, not every tech needs to fit right, every company's mold. And I think these products are so easy to use, and it just takes a little bit. And I'm kind of proof of that. Like, I run now, this is my 7th boot camp I'm running this fall, where I train people, like people off the street, young people, old people, people with, like, trained Harvard graduates and masters in data science, and also like old statistics professor, right? Retired statistics teachers, right? And young working moms, everybody, right? Like, it's not that hard or scary to, like, get your hands dirty and learn how your operating systems work, to run, be able to run code, be able to read code, edit it. It's like learning a second language. So I think everybody needs to learn the second language of coding, to some extent, and every company needs to learn that second language. And the companies that don't, I think, are going to be the ones that are left behind. And you said something before, like, kind of like talking about building websites, right? And, like, you used to build from scratch, like you said, with PHP or WordPress or something like that. And then you have Wix, where you can just buy off the shelf. And now you have this kind of hybrid where you can request a website from ChatGPT or any other generative AI, and it'll give you the code for that. Well, you kind of have an issue where, like, if you went full into Wix or Squarespace, you're trapped. You have to rewrite your website, right, with ChatGPT in order to generate that value. And that's kind of what I'm going to advertise somebody else's book. I wrote a book too, but this book, McKinsey book, Rewired, very good. Talks about, like, I think every company needs to build, like, buying, because the software is free, right? I just said software patents are unenforceable. This stuff is out there. It's free, but it's true for every little piece of software. So if you have the ability in-house to take open source software, piece it together, and create your website, your ordering platform, right, your anomaly detection for your cameras in your factory, a diagnostic tool for x-ray, like, if you have that expertise in-house, now you have a superpower. Where if you don't have that expertise in-house, you have to go through SAP or Salesforce, and you have, right, these are 90% margin businesses, and they'll kind of, you're outsourcing your software development to them and paying an arm and a leg with huge switching costs and all sorts of other garbage, which is why the McKinsey folks are sitting here shouting, being like, please build. The cost of building has gone down dramatically because of open source software. You need to develop the specialty in-house to build, period. And AI makes that easier for you. But that means that every company needs to, it's a hard change for some companies to make, because you go from companies who, like, have no software developers at all, and all the culture issues, and, right, we're used to NetPods and weird remote hours, and we maybe don't shower or something, right? Like, do all this, and we're highly compensated too, right? To, okay, we need to be able to attract software developers, or we need to train our current employees to do some software development work while not paying them software development salaries, and teach them to automate their own jobs away, which is the terrifying thing, right? Like, you, so back to your question, what kind of people do you want? You want people who are motivated enough, and I think it comes a lot to compensation. So why I love equity compensation, it's a finance thing for, like, CEOs, but you want employees that are motivated to automate their own jobs away.
And that's you know, an interesting point, and I appreciate everything you're sharing with me. But one thing I want to go back to then is, and you mentioned you have a course as well. What is something, because I heard you say, you know, having more user friendly experience is not the answer, because, like you said, ChatGPT is very user friendly. You enter something, but, like you said, even then you get a code out. You say, hey, make this website for me. It spits out a code for you. But then people will be like, well, what do I do with this code? I can't take this code to Wix. So what is your thoughts on what people should be thinking about when it comes to learning the second language? What programs, courses, whether it's your own or other ones, that people should be thinking about? Hey, now that these incredible tools are available, I really need to learn the second language of coding. What would you recommend for people to do as, you know, a first two or three things?
Sure. Well, the first thing I have my students do is I have them install Linux. Right. And so Linux is the operating system that powers 90% of servers online. Right. They don't, when I'm going to spin up a server to host a website or database or something like that, I don't pay Windows or don't pay Microsoft $20 for a license. There are no Apple servers anymore for me to use. So I use the open source software called Linux to run my servers. I think Linux is the gateway drug to programming, also the gateway drug to open source software. Free, openly shared, many variants, I would install Linux. After I installed Linux, it's like, can you create a personal website, right? And there's a million, use ChatGPT to create a personal website. And then it's like, I would recommend this great book. I used to teach it. My first boot camp, I taught it, and it still is good. It's free. It's called Automate the Boring Stuff with Python. And I think add ChatGPT in there too. And it's give yourself a little project. And a lot of people I know that are like on the cusp of being really good at this, they're really good at Excel. And for me, I have a huge disdain for Excel because I think Excel doesn't need to exist if you're a good programmer, right? So the first thing you could do is say, all right, I'm living in Excel. I'm doing all these updates. Can I automate some of my Excel stuff with Python? And look that project up. Or I need, right, web scraping is another good one. So Common Crawl scrapes the web, but like maybe I need to get recent data. Maybe I'm a vegetable buyer and I need to know the price of vegetables from a couple different websites. Do a little web scraping project, right? Like there's a ton of little projects out there that have done over and over again. Automate the boring stuff with Python is a great tool for doing that. The other thing you can do, is that a book or is that a YouTube channel? It's a book. So okay. I think it's automatetheboringstuff.com. No starch press. It's very easy to find. The other thing you can do, and by the way, if you want a Harvard quality computer science education, ask ChatGPT. Pay $20 a month, ask ChatGPT, Harvard CS50. I'm going to the talk next week where they're explaining exactly what they're doing in the course. But it's as simple as this. I am Alex. I know this, right? I used to play with PHP. I've built a Wix website before. I'm doing music loyalty routes business right now. I want to learn how to do this. Which programming language should I learn? Okay, ChatGPT will help you. All right, tell me how, it might spit out code. ChatGPT, tell me how to run this code. I'm running an Intel M1 Mac and so on and so, like, just use ChatGPT like a tutor, right? That's what Khan Academy is doing. That's what Harvard's doing right now. So intro computer science is free knowledge now, and you can have a free personalized tutor. And if you need help, there are tools like Wyzant, WYZANT. You can get on-demand help from somebody who will come in and they'll show you, they'll teach you. Right? If you get stuck with your ChatGPT tutor, you've watched the YouTube tutorial, you're still stuck, you pay somebody. Right? And then sometimes it might be right in India or Poland or something, but whatever, for $20, you get an hour of somebody's time to teach you basic Python. They'll share your screen, they'll help you, and you get unstuck. And it's that like piecing together and that outsourcing part too, which I think people are terrible at. Like a lot of this stuff, right? You could, Alex, create the basics of your website with ChatGPT, paste the code in, put a project on Upwork, and be like, and the project is, I want you to deploy this website and I want you to teach me how to update it. There'd be a billion people raising their hands, right? Because computer science education is really good, especially for young people. So you might have a young person, right, in the Philippines, who you're paying $20 an hour, which is an excellent rate for them, and they're like over the moon to help you. So that's how I recommend doing it. There's no like one path, but there's a great, very cheap, highly customizable, highly focused path that you can take. It just kind of takes the scary, learn new things. Like, ooh, like it's just kind of do you have gumption to start it?
You have to take an initiative to want to do it on your own, to try and implement it. And then at times when you get stuck, you just have to ask for help. And then that's the best way to learn and to implement and to grow and to, you know, become more comfortable with it. If you're not going to try it, which this is an active, you know, thing, it's not like a theoretical thing in your head. If you're not going to try it, it's not going to help you, so to speak.
Right, exactly. And that's, for me, it's become a new test for when I'm taking on clients. It's like, they're either clients, I talk to them about automating away work and outsourcing to cheaper places and they get excited, or there are people like, ooh, no, like I could never do that, right? Like, and that's it. It's like, are you excited or not? Like, are you gonna be a new lean company with, right, less bullshit work, fewer employees, highly productive, highly profitable, or are you gonna stay the way you are and die a slow death? And I think that death could be really slow. I think it could be a 30-year bleed, right? It's gonna change at the pace of culture. But like for me, I want to get to the future faster. It's fun. Like, and I don't care about keeping a job with moving the papers from here to there. Right. And meanwhile, but not to disparage everyone doing this, like, I think there are people, and I make a joke, but this is real. It's like, there are people that hand sharpen pencils and will sell hand sharpened pencils. But like, that's not, that's something else. It's like outside of the realm of business. It's like hobby, fun, silly, postmodernist, something or other. But like, I want to compete in the realm of business where productivity matters. And if you want to come with me, right, be ready, because like I'm going to win with automation and outsourcing every time. And that's just it, right? Like if you're not doing those two things and you don't want to do those things, then you're going to lose to somebody who is doing those two things almost every time.
Interesting. Well, you've shared a lot today and I really appreciate that. What's your thoughts about the future in your career and what you want to be doing in the next, you know, 5, 10, 20 years? And where do you think the world is going? Loaded question.
No, it's not. So I'm publishing a book. You can buy it on my website now or go to aiharmony.info, get it. September 12th, it'll be on Amazon, Audible, Spotify, Barnes & Noble. Anyway, so I'm kind of trying to spread the gospel right now. I think I see my peers at, like I said, at like Meta and OpenAI. They're like, it's like Magic HQ. They're creating magic over there. And I see myself as kind of a traveling magician going to the middle of nowhere in Kansas or Philadelphia or whatever and showing you, like, this is the magic trick. Now let me show you how to do it. So I'm very much evangelizing and trying to get people who come, they see the magic and like, please teach me how to do it and try and help them implement that. So, and I'm gonna continue to do that for as long as people want me to work for them, right? So, and gonna keep teaching students how to do that for as long as they want to be taught. My boot camp for October is now filled up. The clients are coming and I'm kind of happy to ride that train for as long as it takes.
So for our listeners, when is your next boot camp and how much are those? If they want to sign up, I can include a link in the show notes as well.
Sure. The next one is October 17th. I do two different payment structures for international students whose salaries might be very low. I take 10% of the increase of their salary, which sounds like a lot, but if you're, let's say, in the Philippines making $10,000 and I up you to $20,000, you owe me $2,000. It's like, okay, and I just doubled your salary. That's kind of how that works
for the first year, or like for 5 years, or
for the first year. And it's done on a handshake. It's like, it's super high trust. It's yeah. There's no contract signed because I'm not gonna, what am I gonna do, sue my student in the Philippines? Like, it's not gonna work. So it's handshake for the international students, and then for students in the US, it's $100 a month for 24 months, and I like do career coaching and like help people get a job after. The bootcamp itself is only 6 weeks, and then we meet after when they're like applying for jobs or setting up their own consulting shops, or even when they get stuck on their projects, call in for office hours with Brad. So
you say students, but what about, you know, we have a lot of executives that are potentially going to be listening to this podcast as well. Like, is students somebody that's like enrolled in university, or what do you consider a student? Like, what if an executive wants to do?
Anybody who's willing, really. I don't say I've had an executive necessarily, because most of the time executives at least pretend like they don't have time to do things like this, but I have had every age, like from, so from 18 to 70, I've taught. I had a blind student last year who I got pretty far with. Like, he's not an employed data engineer today, but he's able to do a lot of programming and Excel work. He's doing a lot for the county and city of Philadelphia right now, and like some of their election work right now. Like I said, I've had stay-at-home moms, mid-career, young students fresh out of school, like I said, Harvard graduates, masters in computer science or whatever. Wait, sorry, question.
Where do people go to sign up for your bootcamp? Because I'm definitely going to sign up, try it. I'm going to, you know, deploy everything you said today. I'm going to try it out. So, yeah.
Sure. You can sign up. It's bradflogger.com. There's a bootcamp link on the top. You'll also see my book there and my solution. So, yeah, if you'd like to sign up, do it. It's a really fun time, and it's one of the my favorite things that I do.
Okay, I'm saying it's a six week boot camp, so it's not like a week type thing. So it is pretty intensive.
It's a lot of self-paced stuff, right? Like I refuse to reinvent the wheel. So where there's tutorials online to learn how to do the basics in Python, you got to do those, and you got to come with me with questions. So it's 6 weeks, but only 12 hours of lecture.
Okay.
is how it works. And I like set you up with a project that's right size for you, which is how I accommodate students of different skill levels. We share problems and solutions, and I teach people the dark side of open source software and Linux and the terminal. I'm obsessed with using the terminal. So user interfaces to me, I want a better user interface. Get out of here. I don't do that stuff. Okay. Like I make you look like you're like in a Mr. Robot TV show or something by the end, which is fun.
Well, I'll be signing up right after this interview in the next few minutes here. So I appreciate you being on today. Is there anything else that you wanted to share or add for our listeners today?
No, this has been great. One thing. So buy my book, but also Wharton crew, follow Dr. Ethan Mollick on LinkedIn or on Twitter. He's a great voice about AI and implementation, putting out some really good research and writing about it.
Dr. Ethan Mollick?
Mollick. His website is oneusefulthing.org. I had him in my Mastering Innovation course with Carl Ulrich and Christian Terswitch. He's fantastic. He's one of Wharton's finest. So I think he deserves our support.
Okay, I'll make sure to add that into the show notes as well. Well, appreciate you being on today. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks, Alex.